Hello and welcome to the 2018 Fremantle Press podcast series. I'm Katie McAllister and I'm here with the author of Afternoons with Harvey Beam, Carrie Cox. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, Katie.
I laughed out loud reading the book, and I don't do that often because I live with my parents and they're like, what are you doing? What are you doing? I explain everything. But I loved it, and I laugh particularly at the radio segments because I'm working in radio at the moment and loving it, and found with the family dynamic, it was very strange kind of understanding Harvey as like a character who had this incredible relationship with the public but had a very fractured relationship with his family and with his sort of private life.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about that and how that can work maybe in radio or in journalism where there's this real like public persona?
Persona. And you can hide behind that a lot. I mean, I think that for a long time, because he did sort of have, not instant, but he quickly had success when he moved to the big city. He got the job he wanted and he built up a profile. He didn't have to deal with, he left all those other issues behind, all that internal work about, you know, working out your family stuff. He never had to do. He just literally left it behind. And I've always thought, can you actually run away with your from your problems? For a long time, that's what Harvey did. I'm kind of fascinated by that concept because I think, well, maybe you can. But then eventually does it come back to, you know, eventually do you have to do the hard work?
Yeah.
So he does hide behind this public persona. He doesn't have to do the hard work. And he largely gets, he doesn't really have to make any big decisions either, because the woman he marries, who we meet through the book, his ex-wife, was very much probably the protagonist in that relationship too. So he was
super
just...
Super mum, super woman Sue. Yeah, incredible.
He was just swept along, I think, and never had to make too many hard decisions. He was good at what he did. And then when he gets back to his hometown, he does have to start looking inward and do it, and asking some bigger questions and doing
some
hard work. He can't run away anymore.
When he comes back to that town, his career is going terribly.
Pear-shaped.
Everything's falling apart.
Everything.
But his private life, his family life, seems to be the best, I guess, that it maybe ever has been. Do you think is there a link between those two things?
I don't know. Not a deliberate one in terms of how I plotted it. Not that I really plotted it much. It evolved. I think that he has been lucky in that his private life, in terms of his ex-wife and his daughters, she did the lion's share of the parenting. And so those kids have ended up, you know, they're okay. The kids are okay, as the old saying goes. And the ex-wife and him still get on as friends. And that whole part of things could have been a lot worse, a lot more fractured. But Harvey got lucky. As for his nuclear family, the one that he grew up with, he soon discovers that things are, that some old rivalries and disconnects are still there, not just between him and siblings, but between his other siblings too. So there are four siblings in that family, and like most, and I'm fascinated with family dynamics and sibling rivalries, and even how the position that you're in a family in terms of when you're born can change and skew things incredibly. And you can speak to three or four different kids from the same family and they will describe three or four very, very different upbringings, even though from the outside looking in, they're all the same factors. I'm really fascinated by that. And so he suddenly had to reconnect with these siblings who have all just stayed in the hometown. So they're, you know, he's the anomaly coming in.
And he's treated that way as well, isn't he? Mm. Really, there's so many comments about, you weren't here, you've come back now, which is really awful, but also fair. He wasn't there.
That's right. And I think there is that. When you talk to people who go back to a hometown after a long period of time, there's a group of people that stay in a hometown, and for good reason. They can be quite resentful of the person who flies in, and, you know, it's almost like an act of betrayal to leave this wonderful place that you grew up from. Not that Harvey ever left the place, because you can tell quite quickly that he's enamoured with aspects of Shorten, the fictional town that he grew up in. Like he reconnects with that river that he spent so much time in. He reconnects with a lot of parts of it, albeit through a more cynical mindset because of his, you know, years in radio and being a shock jock. But there's parts of that he loved, but for other people, he looks like the big city guy coming to town with his big ideas. Yeah, a bit of a hot shot who's going to talk down to us. And he does sometimes, because he's a very flawed character like most of us. He does have a go at the coffee and the standard of service. And what
if
they...
He gets a lot of flack for it.
Yeah, he does. People get very defensive, and understandably so.
Proud of their hometown.
Yeah.
I want to come back to small country towns and what it's like to leave them. But first, before we totally leave the family dynamic,
yes,
Lionel Bear Dean is a total monster. And this man throughout the book is, I know he's lying in bed. He is in so much pain. He's dying of cancer. And I still hate him. I still hate him.
I
want to know, are there any redeeming features that I've missed about this character?
I think that he is, I guess, the most unredeeming character in the novel. And I guess he'd also being in the position of being in his last stages of cancer, he doesn't have much of an opportunity to defend himself anyway, to defend his record.
He has three lines in the whole novel of dialogue. and yet
he is quite this sort of, like, to me, even writing the book, whenever I wrote any part of it that Lionel was in, his character, though he says little, is large. It looms large in all their lives. It's an imposing, even as he's shrinking away in the bed sheets, you know, riddled by the cruelty of cancer, he casts this huge shadow over their lives. And I think what I found interesting too is I've read a lot of books about fathers who, you know, are physically abusive to their kids, and that's an awful thing for any child to ever get over. I don't think you ever do. I was careful about making this less of, this was more an emotional abuse. I think for the most part, Lionel's way of, dividing and conquering his children was the power of neglect and willful indifference, which can be as cruel in some ways as physical abuse.
Even more so, because I think at the start of the novel, Harvey comes across as this real, you know, he is a big shot, sort of shock jock. And then as you learn his past and you learn his history, your heart breaks for this little boy, and you get those snippets.
Yeah. I'm really glad of that, because I did sort of want to break down. I think I'm in my middle age now, and there are times when I still feel that vulnerability of childhood. We are always, you know, I guess even, you know, right at the last stages of our life, we are still our most authentic childhood self, you know. So if the book gets to that point, because he, you know, through the portal of his family, I'm really pleased, because I think that it helps. When I read a book, I do, I guess, selfishly look for things that also teach me more about myself. So I love other people.
We all do.
Do you think? I hope it's not just me.
Why else do we read?
I don't want to tell, like, it's all about me. Yeah. But
well, no, that's how it is.
And I think that in getting to that point with Harvey, even, you know, from an outside, because the book's not told in the first person, but you do get the sense that he too does get there in the end. He does a lot of work to get to the nub of what went wrong with Harvey in the first place, what led him to flee, and what makes him sometimes make the decisions that he does. And he had to be, the layers had to be peeled away, and I think they almost fell away by being at the bedside of his dying father. And perhaps hoping for, I think he says, you know, well, I know he says that, he's pictured this moment. There are conversations that he would love to have in this moment. He would love to think that his father, or any person, would have a deathbed epiphany when there is no more time to cause any more damage. So maybe just make things better. And so you do feel like he's this, like, expectant little child by the bed.
And you're with him on that journey, just wanting that conversation.
To get him to hear what he has to hear. And then I guess the message, though, is that sometimes we need to hear what we need to hear through other means. You know, we can find the resolutions and the comforts we need, not necessarily from the person or the places where they logically should come. Like, it's not going to come from his father. That ship has sailed.
It has, yeah. But from his mother, maybe, and for being back in his hometown.
Yes, sure. Definitely. Yeah. His mother does step up and become more of a figure in his life when she really wasn't in his youth, I don't think. She sort of passively let a lot of things happen that probably shouldn't have happened.
And it was a big decision to write your first book, because this is your first novel.
Yeah, maybe the only one. It took a long time. It's a lot of work.
Tell me about the process, because writing for journalism, which is your background, is entirely different.
Totally different. So I've worked in journalism now for, well, I think it's almost 25 years. I'm, like, really historically old. And so my professional life has always been in non-fiction. I write about the truth, despite what people say about journalists. I do. And so my escape has always been fiction. So my after-hours escape is, you know, getting lost in other worlds. And I don't mean they tend to gravitate to character stories, not sort of other worlds as in science fiction or anything. I do tend to find books that help me understand myself better. And I guess I always had a wonder, like most journalists do, you know, could I create one of these myself? The old saying is that every journalist has a book inside them and that's where it should stay. that's possibly true. Anyway, I was inspired by my daughter. Who is a prolific reader. She reads even more than me. So she's 21 and she said to me about 4 years ago, Mum, let's do NaNoWriMo together. So NaNoWriMo is the National Novel Writing Month that's held in November. I didn't even know, I'd never heard of it. She explained the concept to me and mainly to encourage her, I said, because she was saying to me, I've got all these drawers full of half-written books, and I think that's true of a lot of people. And she said, what I like about this is you just keep going. You get, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 words written every day for a month, and you have a novel at the end of it that obviously needs a lot of editing, but at least you've got that down. I thought, that sounds fun. Let's do it together, and I'll encourage her, and we'll encourage each other. And her wheels fell off about halfway through because she's got an interesting life full of social things. Whereas I kept going with it. It was exactly what I needed. I didn't write a whole novel. I wrote about 30,000 words in the end. But I think I broke the back of it. The secret to that concept working is you just don't have the time to let self-doubt creep in. And that's where I think most novel ambitions fall away.
Can I ask about writer's block in there as well? Do you know how people are, I'm waiting for the inspiration to come, but when you have a deadline and you've just got to meet it, is there any space to have writer's block?
I think you're right. I think that the NaNoWriMo too worked for me because I am deadline driven. So I know that if the deadline is a month, then I'm going to do whatever it takes to get there, although I didn't quite get there, but I definitely broke the back of it. So yes, that appealed to me. I did stick to the WordCan as much as I could. There were just a few days where I couldn't due to kids' commitments and things. But no, that really worked for me. I needed to just get the words on the page and actually, to be honest with you, once I started writing in his voice, which I did right from the start,
that's so distinctive, such a distinctive voice.
That character just, it's all about him. That he is the, you know, the driving force of the novel. And that never felt, I never struggled with that. I struggled with other parts of the novel, but I never struggled with Harvey. That was like putting on a coat and going, this fits perfectly. And that voice just was always the easiest thing to nail. And the other parts were hard. So with that, and I think I feel really lucky that, and it almost started with his name, actually. Just like I, when I write journalism, I can't write a single word until I've written the lead, you know, the lead being the first paragraph. That's how I write. And once I had his name, I was off.
I wanted journalism, I guess, is often criticised because the 24-hour news cycle, like, yes. It's so fast and it's hard to get into a topic with depth and
absolutely.
To be slow, like, slow about understanding anything, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, how did you find shifting to spending so much time with one idea, even though you did, you know, write it in sort of feature article style, to sit with something for so long?
Do you mean the whole book?
Like, yeah, how was that?
Yeah, that was completely new for me. Yeah. That part of it was a different experience, but it was an enjoyable experience. And I remember there were mornings. I did a lot of my writing at Karen Up Library. I would go physically put myself in the library to remove myself from the drudgery of domestic duties at home. And I would have moments, I don't know, maybe every couple of weeks, where I would say, this feels so different and I love it. You know, I just really loved it. It was so foreign to me. It's nice at 45 years of age to feel something different.
Yeah, and I think that happens to Harvey in the book
as well. That's where I think I definitely was tapping into something there that's real to me, where he sort of says he's questioning whether anything can still surprise you in your mid-40s. Like, have I already had every conversation I'm ever going to have? Am I still just meeting the same five people over and over? And so when you are surprised by either something that you do yourself or that you experience, the possibility of reinvention in your, you know, middle years, that to me is exciting and really worth exploring.
Wow, I want to finish on family. We started at family.
Yes.
I think we're almost out of time.
Sure.
In terms of Harvey and, I guess, coming back, understanding his family and understanding how that fits maybe in his broader career, what do you think, I guess, in your mid-40s, what should people like Harvey be aiming for, I guess, in their mid-40s, like to, yeah.
I think that I heard a saying once that resonated for me, and it said, the most important family is the one you create yourself. I think I put that in the book. I probably did. I'm very predictable like that. It really resonates for me. You know, my parents did the best they could. But if I was to take their methods and apply them now, it wouldn't work. My kids are living in an age of social media. All the pressures on a family have changed. So I don't think... And they also live miles away. So I'm very much flying blind with this parenting thing. And so I do think that regardless of, you know, what was right or wrong about your childhood and what still hurts, you have this opportunity with your own family to try and get as much of it right as you can. And I think that the basis of that is providing them with the best foundation of love that you can. You know, I think that... life is hard these days for young people. It's really hard.
It really is.
Yeah, I've had some, you know, I've been working on an article lately about youth suicide, and it's really been a difficult one to write, you know. And as a parent, I keep stopping myself, stopping being a journalist and starting being a parent, and going, God, I've really got to get this right. I've got to do, not that people deliberately get it wrong. They don't. I'm saying I've just got to, I've got to try my hardest. There's no guarantee I'll be successful, but God, I'm going to try.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that with me and with our listeners. Are there any books that we can look forward to in the future?
I hope so. I'm going to see how this one goes. I sometimes think that there's another book in Harvey, or maybe I'll do something completely different. But it's sitting with me at the moment. It's sort of germinating. Yeah.
Okay. Can't wait to read it.
Thank you so much, Katie. Thank you.